on this edition for Saturday, March 28th, the impacts of the coronavirus pandemic, strains on the healthcare safety net, and could the stimulus package give a boost to the concept of universal basic income? Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening and thanks for joining us. We are bringing you our broadcast tonight from remote locations across the country for the second weekend. I'm not in the two studios. I'm here at home with my family. Our guests have joined us using technology that allows us to have conversations, just as many of you and your families are these days, for school, work, and social connection in this time of social distancing. Our reporters, producers, and editors are also working from their homes and gathering the news when it's safe to do so. Let's get started with today's top news. President Trump suggested today that he is considering a, quote, quarantine for New York, New Jersey, and parts of Connecticut.
Some people would like to see New York quarantined because it's a hot spot. New York, New Jersey, maybe one or two other places. Certain parts of Connecticut quarantined. I'm thinking about that right now. We might not have to do it, but there's a possibility that sometime today we'll do a quarantine, short term, 2 weeks on New York, probably New Jersey, certain parts, and Connecticut.
Mr. Trump left the White House today for a trip to Norfolk, Virginia for the launch of a Navy hospital ship. Hospitals nationwide are preparing for a surge in coronavirus cases. Ventilators to treat the most serious cases are still in short supply. Governors and mayors are calling for more help with equipment and relief for frontline healthcare workers.
We've all been focused so much on supplies, on equipment, on ventilators. We need to focus increasingly on our healthcare personnel, both everything they're going through and how we help them now, but the fact also we're going to need a lot more people. We're going to need a lot more highly trained healthcare professionals to get us through this in the coming weeks.
The United States now has more confirmed cases of COVID-19 than any other country. According to Johns Hopkins University's Coronavirus Resource Center, there are now more than 104,000 cases reported in the U.S. and more than 1,700 deaths. More than 230 million people in the U.S. are now under state and local orders to stay at home to try to slow the spread of the coronavirus. While tens of millions of Americans are under stay-at-home orders, President Trump left the White House today and flew to Norfolk, Virginia. The president wanted to see off the U.S. Navy's hospital ship, the Comfort, as it headed to New York City. The 1,000-bed ship is expected to arrive on Monday. The Mercy, another of the Navy's massive medical support ships, arrived in Los Angeles yesterday. The Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center reported today that confirmed coronavirus cases worldwide have topped 600,000, killing more than 28,000 people and putting thousands of healthcare workers around the world at risk. The World Health Organization's Director General said yesterday that the international community must work together to combat the shortage of protective equipment for healthcare workers.
WHO has shipped almost 2 million individual items of protective gear to 74 countries that need it most, and we're preparing to send a similar amount to a further 60 countries. But much more is needed.
In Spain and Italy, despite complete shutdowns for weeks, the two countries have recorded more than 14,000 deaths combined. Authorities in India sent buses to the outskirts of the capital, New Delhi, today to help migrant workers return to their home villages. Thousands of unemployed workers have been trying to walk to their homes after the country's nearly complete lockdown. And in Wuhan, China today, 6 subway lines reopened to the public 3 days after bus service resumed, but passengers are required to register their names to record their travel before boarding. Oklahoma Representative and Senator Tom Coburn died today. Coburn, a Republican, was an obstetrician and became known as Dr. No during his time in office for his opposition to federal spending. Coburn died from complications from prostate cancer. He was 72 years old. For more on the outbreak and the 2020 presidential race, visit pbs.org/newshour. In a sign of the economic toll COVID-19 is taking, more than 3 million Americans filed for unemployment benefits last week, a record number. According to the Kaiser Health Foundation, close to half of employees receive health insurance from their employer. That means more than 1.5 million people might now be not only out of a job, but without health insurance as well. As you might imagine, that has only intensified the national conversation about universal health care. I recently spoke about that with Sarah Collins, Vice President for Healthcare Coverage and Access at the Commonwealth Fund. Right now, we had these enormous numbers of people that were filing for unemployment, and that number may grow. And the reason we're talking to you about this is so many Americans have healthcare tied to their employer. So what kind of a strain are we going to see on the healthcare system and on the safety net in the next few weeks?
No, it's a really major loss of jobs, unprecedented actually in terms of the number of increase, and will be an unprecedented loss of people with employer-based coverage. Most people get their coverage through an employer, so it's a big hit to the health insurance system and to people who are now covered through employer-based plans.
So what about the fail-safe systems that we have in the Affordable Care Act or the Medicaid expansion?
This is a really important protection now that we have that we wouldn't have had 10 years ago had it not been for the Affordable Care Act. So if you lose your job and you had coverage through your job, you are eligible automatically for a special enrollment period through the ACA marketplaces. So it's what's really important for people to do right now is to go to healthcare.gov and check out your options through the marketplaces. You may also be eligible for Medicaid. So you might get coverage through Medicaid, but if you go to that website, you can find out what your options are. You might be eligible for a subsidy. Your income probably is dropping a lot. And so you can be eligible for a subsidy to offset the cost of your premiums or be eligible for Medicaid in your state.
Does what we're living through now shine a different light on the conversation about universal healthcare?
I think it really does. About 30 million people are still uninsured. And so you're seeing in congressional bills attempts to patch that up by covering the costs, requiring insurers to cover the cost of testing, for example. We're considering other options. 11 states have new special enrollment periods for their marketplaces so that people can get enrolled who are uninsured. And we're likely to see a nationwide effort to open up the marketplaces for people. But I think that this should be a baseline feature of our healthcare system. We should know going into a crisis like this that everyone has health insurance coverage. We're not trying to insure people to protect themselves from catastrophic healthcare costs. This is a very serious illness. And if people end up in the hospital without insurance, they're going to face major bills. If they can't pay those bills, then the hospitals are going to have to find a way to come up with the funding to pay those bills. And I think it's a reckoning for the United States to look closely at how we can expand coverage to get to universal coverage. And there are lots of ways we can do that. Vice President Biden has proposed building on the Affordable Care Act to get to universal coverage. Senator Sanders has proposed Medicare for All. These are very different paths, but they ultimately lead to the same place.
What's the biggest thing you're worried about?
I'm very concerned that that people are going to not get care because of their insurance status. I'm worried that when they do go to get care, that they're going to be very, very sick and that they won't they'll get major bills and not able to pay those bills. And hospitals are also deeply in financial trouble because of that as well.
Considering the legislation that Congress has already passed, what should people know about this?
Well, they should know that all insurers and employers have to cover the tests associated with coronavirus, and it has to be without cost sharing, so you won't face any costs. And states can also cover people who are uninsured through their Medicaid programs and for the costs of testing. But importantly, this does not include treatment. So if you get sick, you're uninsured, your treatment costs aren't covered. So that's a gap that still needs to be addressed. So one thing the administration could do is to expand that coverage for testing to treatment through the Medicaid program. Medicaid is an incredibly flexible program in a crisis. It's often drawn on to respond to natural disasters or epidemics like this. And the administration could do much more than it's doing with the Medicaid program right now to help patients and also hospitals that they're getting care from.
Sarah Collins of the Commonwealth Fund. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The federal stimulus package, which will provide relief checks to some families impacted by the pandemic, has reignited the idea of universal basic income. The concept has been floated in academic and think tank circles and even made it onto the Democratic debate stage with candidate Andrew Yang. But when it comes to actually implementing UBI, well, for that it's best to hear from the people putting it into practice. In Stockton, California, a pilot program called the Stockton Economic Empowerment Demonstration, or SEED, has distributed $500 a month to 125 city residents for more than a year. Philanthropically funded, the program will be completing its run this July. I spoke with Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs, SEED Director Suki Samra, and the program's lead researchers, Dr. Stacia Martin-West from the University of Tennessee College of Social Work, and Dr. Amy Castro-Baker from the University of Pennsylvania School of Social Policy and Practice. This is part of our ongoing initiative, Chasing the Dream, Poverty and Opportunity in America. Mayor, let me start with you. What was the reason for this experiment in the first place?
The reason we started to see the experiment was understanding even before this coronavirus crisis that a lot of Americans were living in a time of economic insecurity, severe economic insecurity. At that point, we knew that one in two Americans were one $400 emergency away from financial ruin. In Stockton, my city, 23% of the folks are at the poverty line, and I would argue another 30% are one paycheck away. And for all the things we're working on in the city, from education to violent crime reduction to economic development, I think at the heart of it is poverty and is how many people are economically insecure.
Stacia Martin-West, what kind of things are you measuring?
Sure. So what we're really interested in seeing is the public health impacts of a guaranteed income. The sort of data that we're collecting looks at things like stress and well-being, how people are doing psychologically, how they're doing in their families, how they're doing with employment. And the data that we've gotten back so far, the community was really interested to know, and I think most folks are, is how do people spend this $500, right? Mm-hmm. So what we've seen so far is that about 40% of the money has been spent on food. About 25% of the money each month is spent at big box stores or places like Walmart and Target. And so what this speaks to is that lower income families prioritize the needs of their families, and we can trust them to do so, and we can trust them to make rational financial decisions.
What we know from, you know, a lot of years of social science and public health data is that most American households are food insecure. So again, speaking to what Dr. West just said, when we think about the ways in which most families are struggling and living paycheck to paycheck, food is one of the things that's flexible, right? So it's one of those things that we can, you know, actually adjust our spending on. And what we're learning through SEED, which builds on a pretty big body of knowledge, is that the quality of food and the quantity of food shifts based on how much money is in the household.
Mayor, I'm sure you've heard the counter narrative. This is not going to help anything. The people you give this money to are going to spend it the wrong way. This is essentially just a free handout. When this project was rolling out, how did you push back against that?
The responses were multifaceted. I think the first response was it really goes down, again, to fundamentally who do we trust as a country. In 2017, we had a conversation about tax cuts where $1 trillion were given to the richest Americans and corporations. And I venture to say I've received more questions about what people have done with the $1 million philanthropically funded basic income demonstration than what all these folks did with trillions of dollars of our tax money as a form of stimulus. And it's because we implicitly trust people who have power or who are rich or who have positions to make decisions, or we don't trust people that are actually more in line and more similar to the vast majority of Americans, people like us who are just regular working folks. And then number two, I think, and the research that the researchers have found illustrates to us that people are rational actors, that the issue with economic insecurity isn't because people are mismanaging money or isn't because people are dumb. Or is it even because people are not working and are lazy? The issue is that people don't have enough cash, that wages have not kept up with the cost of living and with utility increases, and that people are actually making very complex and complicated decisions day by day, month by month, based on the income that they do receive. And then the last thing I would say to folks is that this is not some foreign idea. This idea is deeply rooted in our American ethos and values, particularly around opportunity and particularly around the fact that everyone's contributing, that people, particularly women who are staying home and doing domestic work and caregiving, they're doing work and that's not being compensated. I think a basic income or income floor is a logical extension of some of the New Deal protections, et cetera.
Suki Samra, this might be a procedural question, but how do people get the $500? Is it cash? Is it a check in the mail?
So the money is dispersed every month on a prepaid debit card that we actually issued in folks' name. So everyone has what's called a focus card that has their own name on it. And each month on the 15th or as close to the 15th as possible, we load the $500. From there, folks are able to spend it just like you would any other debit card. They can transfer the money onto their own accounts and they can withdraw as well.
Mayor, you know now that Congress is passing a massive bailout. Part of that includes a direct payment to individuals. When you hear this plan, what goes through your mind?
It's a great start, but definitely far from a finish, particularly knowing that this crisis is going to be longer than 1 month, knowing that people will be out of work for longer than 1 month, and knowing that the impacts of this will last longer than 1 month. It makes no sense to persist that 1 month is going to be enough to help people navigate through this crisis. So I think it's a start, but I think the amount should be larger and it should go as long as the coronavirus pandemic lasts.
You're saying that this shouldn't just be a single payment. It should continue through this pandemic. I can hear members of the audience saying, wait a minute, how are we going to pay for that? Look at how long it took just to try to get this package approved.
If you look at any kind of massive response, whether it's a war or a public health issue, our nation marshals the resources to do what's necessary to make sure we emerge stronger. And I think in this instance, with this pandemic, we have to dig deep and look at sort of almost the president has called himself a wartime president. So we need a wartime budget, but one that's focused on arming the American people with the financial and economic security they need to fight back during these times.
Mayor, what kind of effect has this had? Are the people that are getting these $500, are they drawing less on city services?
What I've seen is that folks have actually availed themselves to more of the city services, but not in a draining or parasitic way, but to contribute. So I've met seed participants at different community events and town halls and things of that sort, and who are now engaged civically in their community because they feel seen and a part of, which is phenomenal. But the research team in Suki would probably have more granular information about really the impacts on social services that the city or the county provides.
Suki Samra, do you have examples for how people are increasing their productivity in the city thanks to this money?
Sure. Over the course of the demonstration, we've definitely seen folks becoming more civically engaged and feeling more involved. Maggie, who serves as a caretaker for her husband who had a stroke, but who is now also writing letters to the record in support of, you know, stuff like the guaranteed income demonstration. When we had our primary, she was like, I went and voted and I got my entire family to vote as well. So I think over and over again, we're seeing that they're more, that they have a call to action that didn't previously exist.
Mayor, this program is going to end. So let's say best case scenario, the researchers come up with great findings. How do you keep this going?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a big part of our strategy has been to kind of be open about the data and what we're learning, to invite folks in. And I've been having conversation with senators and presidential candidates and governors and assembly people and state senators, because the only way this will work will be at a statewide or national level. I think the coronavirus pandemic gives us an opportunity to pilot what an emergency basic income would look like. And I think the data from this program and the stories of the recipients will give us an army of folks who can effectively advocate about how an investment directly in the hands of folks of the United States is the most important investment we can make as a country, as a state government. So I will continue working and leading those advocacy efforts and hopefully the next couple of years, we have some sort of income floor for the vast majority of Americans.
Are there particular findings in the data that make you optimistic?
Yeah, I mean, part of what we're seeing so far is affirmation of what those of us who work in social services, social work, in behavior, like things like behavioral economics, have known for a really long time, which is that the people who budget best are people who are living at or below the poverty line. So contrary to our assumptions about how money is spent and who knows how to budget and not budget, what we're seeing with the early data is that people who are living paycheck to paycheck know to the day to the hour when their money's going to run out. So they came into the experiment having a plan for exactly where they were going to spend it. And that type of spending patterns and behaviors lowers anxiety and it increases healthy outcomes, right? So what we're seeing, you know, right now in that spending data is more affirmation that when we trust our people and we invest in everyday Americans who are the ones who are holding up the economy, that what we will see is not only positive health outcomes, but positive economic outcomes. You know, one of the things that we get asked a lot is, well, how much can $500 really do? It's so expensive to live in California, the economy's bad, housing's expensive. And what we've seen with Stockton is how far that $500 can go and the ways in which it's alleviating other problems in the market.
So to be clear, this is not a replacement for the city's safety net.
It absolutely is not. That's one of the key findings that we have from the Stockton experiment, is that if you implement a guaranteed income, it has to happen alongside the existing safety net. The first feedback that we received from the city and from focus groups that we were conducting is, how is this going to interact with my food stamp benefits? Or does this mean I won't be able to have Medi-Cal anymore? So that's more evidence of people making rational decisions for their families, right? Is it actually worth receiving this $500 if it means that I'm going to have a reduction in my SNAP benefits? So as we think about scaling this out, we have to have a plan that allows people to maintain the current level of benefits that they're receiving, as well as receive the unconditional cash.
Mayor, how prepared is Stockton, California for what could be a very long slog through this pandemic?
We are working very, very closely with our state and federal officials. I think like every other hospital system, we need more ventilators. We need more hospital beds. We need more ICU beds. And we're doing the best with what we have and preparing accordingly. And I think our frontline workers are doing a phenomenal job. And I mean, again, this is something we'll have to learn from and make sure we have even more preparedness. But definitely, like most other communities, we're worried about a shortage of beds, of ICU beds and of ventilators. And that's why, again, that stay-at-home directive is so important for folks to realize that we're being preventative, that we're trying to ensure that we don't become like Italy and other countries that are making really difficult decisions about how to allocate scarce resources. One of the biggest learnings for me just this past week was how, given the world we live in, where this year it's coronavirus, next year, the year after, it could be some natural disaster. A couple years after that, it could be another public health emergency. That's more important that we get the foundation good and ready now. So I was already sold on a guaranteed income, but now I'm more than sold because I see now, particularly in a world that moves so fast where things like this are becoming more and more commonplace, that folks need a firm foundation. And as my mom always says, if we stay ready, we won't have to get ready, so that folks are in a better position the next time some sort of pandemic or natural disaster happens. That this has to be part of our national resilience strategy. How do we make sure that every American has at least something to persist through what's becoming more and more common?
Mayor Michael Tubbs of Stockton, California. Suki Samra, director of the SEED program there. Stacia Martin West from the University of Tennessee College of Social Work. And Amy Castro-Baker, University of Pennsylvania School of Social Policy and Practice. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
finally tonight, Reverend Joseph Lowry, the civil rights leader and a key ally of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., died yesterday. Lowry was a pastor in Mobile, Alabama when he met King in the 1950s. He went on to help found the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which he led for 20 years. In 2009, Lowry gave the benediction at President Barack Obama's inauguration.
Help us to make choices on the side of love, not hate. On the side of inclusion, not exclusion. Tolerance, not intolerance. And as we leave this mountaintop, help us to hold on to the spirit of fellowship and the oneness of our family.
Joseph Lowry was 98 years old. That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Bernard and Irene Schwartz, Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Rosalind P. Walter, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
When it comes to wireless, Consumer Cellular gives its customers the choice. Our no-contract plans give you as much or as little talk, text, and data as you want. And our U.S.-based customer service team is on hand to help. To learn more, go to consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.